finished grading your exam, and actually overall I think class did quite well. I posted the distribution, which I'll show you later. It's already on the web, and I'll hand your exams back and give you some insight as to how you ought to interpret your grade with respect to the distribution and such. Sorry. Okay, the other thing is just to point out that workshops, because of the fall break, the new workshop begins today, so that we'll have to go through next Tuesday, so that everybody has a class to take that workshop, has a chance to take that workshop. So the new workshop cycle will always begin on Wednesday. Until Thanksgiving, I guess, we'll get back on the Monday to Friday schedule. I've also sent out an email this morning about a midterm survey for our PAs, and we do take that seriously. We do give the information back to the PAs, and we discuss things that are going right, things that are going wrong, strategies to improve. It's sometimes a way, there might be something, you know, very broken, and I might have no idea about it, so it's really good for you to go ahead and fill these things out. If you're sitting there thinking, well, I'm sort of happy, so I'm not going to bother, that's also not good, because we like to use the good news to help reinforce that with our TAs, and we actually use it for TA awards and things like that. Anyway, I would appreciate it if you take a few minutes for that. It's an online thing, and I don't think it'll take you all that long. So I hope you'll do that. I'll probably send out another reminder soon. Anything about the class? I'll hand the exam back at the end of this class and give you some interpretation for the curve of the exam. If somebody would stop me, I guess I'm caught up in thinking about that. So rather than any class, any lecture at 1:45, somebody sort of gets my attention a few minutes before that, and I'll hand the exam back and find the curve to you. Anything about class? Any questions? Okay. So last time we were talking about work and energy, and one of the things that we said was that energy is conserved, and this is a very fundamental law that underlies all of science as we know it. It doesn't actually mean that it's a useful thing for you if you're trying to do a problem, because energy in some global sense may be conserved, but you may not have the information to sort of reconstruct that. There are other problems where you have an isolated system and you're dealing with a force where, boy, that doesn't look so good there. Sorry, let me see if I can help this. But I guess the focus is not so great either. And am I crazy, or the colors look a lot worse than usual?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do look worse than usual, or yeah, I'm crazy. Okay, well, we're sort of stuck. Sorry about that. So if you're in an isolated system and you understand how the energy flows within that system, and you don't have something complicated happening, like maybe friction or sound being produced, or the hand of God reaching in to do something, then you might be able to understand how the energy flows in the system, and when you do, you can use energy conservation to give you a quantitative equation that describes things, which you would sort of basically say the energy at the start is equal to the energy at the end. And you can put that in mathematics, and you have a mathematical constraint on the problem. So So that's really useful. Now, we are considering some problems where we have a lot of what we're going to be talking about will be what we call conservative systems. So these are systems where understanding the energy flow is pretty simple. These are systems where the energy within the system depends only on the endpoint. So in terms of the spring, if you talk about the potential energy in the spring, that depends on the position of the spring, how stretched or compressed it is. And if I do a problem where that position changes, the energy stored in the spring only depends on those endpoints. You don't have to worry about whether I stretched it and came back or not. That doesn't matter. That kind of thing we call a conservative force. Non-conservative forces are things where it's a bit more complicated. So for example, if you have friction, you can lose energy to friction, and what happens to it is it turns into heat, basically, and it's lost. If you have a problem and you have enough information to calculate the friction, you may actually use that within sort of an energy conservation formula, okay? Where you basically say, okay, I start with so much energy, and it goes into a change in potential energy, a change in kinetic energy, and so much energy lost through friction. So that's how I like to think about these things. If you want to put that in some sort of formula form, it's usually written like this, where the work done to non-conservative forces, think friction, or if there's something that's input in the problem that has nothing to do with the change in the height or how the spring moves, that is equal to the change in the kinetic energy plus the change in the potential energy. I just tend to think it through better, sort of following the energy through the problem. Set it up, think about where the energy is, and then think about where it goes, and then try to translate that into math. I actually find that to be a much more straightforward way of doing it. At any rate, we'll typically consider two basic systems when we're thinking about energy flow, gravity and springs. I don't know that I can stand here and promise you that's all we'll see, but that's likely, I think that's all we'll see. And you hit 114, you'll find that the force of the electromagnetism is also a conservative system, and you'll add that to your list. At any rate, one of the things about conservative systems is that you can really understand the potential energy of the system and how it depends on position. And we looked at last time how if I take a spring and I stretch it out, I'm doing work to that spring, so I'm adding energy to that spring if you want to think about it. So how does the energy in the spring change and how does it depend on how much work I put into it? So what we found was that, if I'm going to stretch the spring, I'm exerting a force on the spring to stretch it out. I go through a distance so I can calculate how much energy it takes. That force is changing as I stretch it. So it's not just some fixed F times some fixed D. It's more complicated, and we had to sum it up over all the little pieces. So we did an integral in order to derive that. And when we did it, we found that the energy of the spring, the energy stored in the spring, so we call it potential energy, depends on how much the string is compressed or stretched relative to its natural length. And it goes as 1/2 times K, K being the spring constant that defines how stiff the spring is, times that distance squared, whether it's compressed or stretched. It's just the difference in that natural length squared. So it's 1/2 KX squared. So if we look at that potential energy, if you think about how that potential energy depends on the position X, you can actually graph it. And this is just a quadratic function, so this is actually supposed to be at 0, sorry. So as you stretch the spring out in X, so as I pull it out, the energy increases as 1/2 kx squared. So if I now plot the amount of energy, it's going to go up as a quadratic. As I compress the spring, so I go to negative X over here, it's the same thing. Because this is symmetric in that X squared. Doesn't matter, it was positive negative. So I'll get a quadratic that's a mirror image of what I have over here going up the other way. So this curve really describes how the energy of the system depends on where you are. And we call that the potential energy curve, or the potential function. That's what it's typically called. We will see this a lot in chemistry, for example. If you want to describe the van der Waals force or something, very often what you'll see plotted is the potential as a function of distance between the two pieces, two atoms or whatever. So this is a very common thing. Now, one of the reasons that it's so powerful is, remember, that energy is a scalar. You can sort of think your way through it a little bit easier. You don't have to get twisted up with directions too often. So often it's easier to sort of figure it out. Also, experimentally in the lab, it's much easier to figure out potential functions or energy than it is to figure out forces. So an example would be, if you do want to understand the chemical bond, for example, I can't just go in with a pair of tweezers and figure out the force between these two charged particles. So what do? I blast it with a photon of a certain energy, and if the photon has enough energy, it blasts it out. If it doesn't, it won't. And that sort of gives you a measure of how much energy is being held, how much force is being. So this marriage between force and energy is really a useful thing in the real world. So when you move beyond this class and everything, you'll actually see this kind of thing a lot. So just get used to it. So the actual relationship between the potential function and the force that's on the particle, I want to think through this way. Suppose I do a little bit of work to the spring, stretch it out just a tiny bit. Then the amount of work that I do goes, so it's just a little differential now because I only move it a tiny bit. So that's going to be equal to the force that I'm exerting on times the distance through which I move it. So the force is just kx, right, depending on whatever x I'm at. But this is the basic relationship. Remember that this amount of work that I'm doing is really a change in the potential energy of the string, which is basically a change in this function. It's a change in the potential. So I'm actually moving a little bit in x and asking how much do I move up this curve. So du is the same as this dw. And so I can pull the dx down, and I get the change in this potential energy function with respect to distance is really a measure of the force. So now I specifically ask, how much work do I do on that string? Because that's easy for me to think through and explain in terms of work. But what's really more relevant, usually, is asking what is the force that the system has on the object that's moving in it. So if I have something that's on the spring, I'm usually asking what kind of force is the spring exerting on it, which is going to be equal and opposite in direction from the force that I have to exert. So I throw in a minus sign here. And this is really the more general formula. And let's look at it. The derivative of this f of x is going to be kx, right? I pulled the 2 down. So if I go out a little bit in x, what I'm telling you is there's a force that's equal to kx in magnitude. But kx is a positive number when I'm over here, and I need a negative number because I need a restoring force. Whatever the object is that's hooked to the spring, as it goes out a little further, there's a force toward the center. And that's what this minus sign gives you. Okay? If I go to the other side, remember x is negative, and you need a positive force because you want to point in the positive direction. So that sort of justifies this minus sign. This is really a three-dimensional thing. So rather than give you three-dimensional problems, I'm going to promise you that anything we see in this nature will be a one-dimensional thing. What we just saw was a string where I'm moving in the x, okay, and I gave you a formula in the x. If we have two masses and they're moving apart gravitationally, they will change in the r, the distance between them. I could cook up some other system, but whatever it is, it's going to be a one-dimensional system. So to represent that in some sort of general way, if I have some coordinate, which I'll call S, okay, the force along the S direction goes as the negative derivative of the change of the potential function as a function of that coordinate. Okay? Sorry. I had a cold over the weekend, so I'm probably going to cough right into the microphone. And all right, so we just did that. So the next thing I want to do is look at gravitation. But before I do that, I'm going to do it again. So any questions on this? So we have before us a simple pendulum, which is a big mass hanging from a string, okay? And I'm going to pull this mass out so that it, by some measure, let's say the top of it is equal to where this rope is. And I'm going to let it go, and it's going to go swinging in. All right? And when it does, what I'd like you to do is to tell me whether you think, what do you think is most likely to happen? That it will stop here, that it will go up and stop at about the height where it started, or that it will swing around. Okay? And so let's see if we can get this thing to work. Windows has recovered from an unexpected shutdown. There's a surprise. Get it going, yeah, you type one and press an enter. So it should work now, in principle. Some of you are succeeding. So while you're doing that, joining the class, the answers will be given to you, or I'll need you to give answers in terms of letters, because that's how it's set up to do right now. So let's call this one A, this one B, and this one C, and think for a moment as to which one you think it ought to be. Two of you. That's starting to verge on pretty pathetic. Try to remember to bring it because you totally kill this thing if you don't bring it. Alright. So we're up to 35. Alright, so for A, you think if it comes around, it's going to go a little ways and stop. B, you think it's going to go up to about the same height. C, you think it's just going to go around. So go ahead and answer. So most of you said B. We have a smattering at C and A. So most of you think it's going to go back up to here. Some of you say here or here. If you think it's going to stop at B, tell me why. because when I give this to you, I'm going to demand you tell me why. Yeah.
The conservation of energy?
What does that got to do with anything?
After this potential, then it's converted to kinetic, and then the conservation of momentum from that point, so then it has to...
Oh, what was that M word?
Momentum.
What the hell is that? Dude, you're in chapter 7. We're strictly not there yet. Has nothing to do with momentum yet. And certainly nothing to do with angular momentum. Okay? Alright, so he says the words energy conservation. So how do you think about that? How much energy does this system have in it? You go, I don't know. Well, think about it. You're starting right here. You're not moving. So you have no kinetic energy. Okay? Do you have gravitational potential energy? That depends on where you define the zero of potential energy. For this problem, what you want to do is to define the zero of potential energy here, probably for simplicity, because that's as low as it goes. So once you say that you define it that way, then you sort of have a mental picture of how the potential energy can depend on where you are. So if I define the zero of the height here, okay, then I'm up some height, it doesn't matter what it is, let's call it just some distance h, okay? So that would mean that this thing, when it's sitting right here, has mgh in potential energy, okay? Now, as it goes down, that potential energy is converted into kinetic energy. So here, I have kinetic energy, 1/2 mv², so it's now moving fast at the bottom, okay? Right before it hits this post. And the potential energy has gone from mgh down to zero. Now, you could argue that you're going to lose a little energy here as this rope sort of exerts friction against this post. And that's true. Okay? But it's going to be a relatively small amount. And that is one of the reasons that we have a big honking ball here. Okay? Is because we basically want the change in the potential energy and the kinetic energy to be very big compared to the reality of losing tiny bits, because you have a tiny bit of friction up here, you have a tiny bit of air friction, okay? So if you get hung up on that, it's a symptom of thinking a little too hard about it, okay? Go be an engineer. This is physics, and we try to simplify things as much as we can. So this thing, now this energy gets converted back into potential energy, and it's going to go fast, right, as it goes through here, and as it goes up, that energy gets converted into potential energy, and it can only convert back into as much as it started with, so it can only get back mgh in potential energy. So, and in fact, that's what it has to get back, unless that energy has gone somewhere else. So regardless of what I do here, as long as I'm not absorbing too much energy, this thing goes back up to the same time. Okay? You can rest easy. Energy conservation still works. In case you were concerned, you now know. All right. Okay, so what I'd like to do is to talk about gravity. Unless you think Newtonian gravity is boring, I want to spend a moment to sort of put what Newton did in some perspective. And then we'll talk about gravity proper. But I want to take a trip back in history. Trip back in time. There was a time people's perception of the universe about us. And my guess is that people still have a pretty bizarre perception of the universe about us. But those of us who actually are educated in the concepts of science and the evidence that we have around us, the perception of the universe has changed dramatically since the days of the Pythagoras school of thought. But back in the day, the Greeks they were big into geometry. And it's not a totally crazy idea, because if you really look at the guts of what's happening in string theories today, one of the things that Hume has, it's actually geometry. So, but nevertheless, they were really hung up on geometry and the idea of perfect shapes and everything. And, you know, you want to live in this beautiful world where the heavens are perfect or whatever, and so they have the objects somehow appended to spheres up in the heavens. So when they sat and they looked outside, obviously, if you haven't done this, you should do this. We actually sort of lose touch with the skies. It's a little, one of the tragedies of modern society is that the lights are so bad that you don't actually spend much time looking at this amazing, beautiful reality show, which is the sky itself. It's really beautiful. So if you haven't had the chance, someday get a good friend, a bottle of wine, and go on a very clear night out into the middle of nowhere in Vermont or Arizona or something, and just put a blanket down and watch the show. You'll find it's absolutely stellar, better than anything you've ever seen on TV. At any rate, a long time ago, you didn't have a lot of choices, okay? Might argue you still don't, but it's a little different. So people were really aware of what happened in the sky. And the basic picture of the universe at the time was that if you sit there, the universe basically goes around us. So you have this Earth-centered universe, a geocentric universe, and it was noticed that the planets, so the sun and the moon and the stars, go around sort of in different ways, different rates. And so you could deal with that by putting them on different big spheres out there. And so this is sort of the early view of our universe and our place in the universe. And then as people studied things a little more carefully, they realized that, you know, for the planets, things were not quite so simple. If you actually look at Mars very carefully, to explain it from our point of view, if you go around the sun, if Earth is going around the sun and Mars is going around the sun, if you think about how Mars looks to people on Earth relative to the stars in the far background, okay, what you'll find is that Mars seems to actually go backwards and then come back and go forward again. And it happens as Earth basically overcomes the position of Mars with respect to the angle as it goes around the Earth. So as Earth goes like this, right in this period, this motion of Mars will sort of seem to stall, go back, and then go back forward. This is known as retrograde motion. And there's a problem with that, because it's really inconsistent with the picture of everything just on these spheres and being completely independent. So that's pretty bizarre. So Plato got around this by having multiple spheres. Aristarchus actually proposed a sun-centered universe to explain this, but I mean, how crazy is that? So nobody really went for that. Ptolemy came up with the idea about 100 AD that, I mean, because you really want to preserve the whole sphere thing, because that's a perfect shape, okay? And whatever's in the heavens, it's got to be perfect. So Ptolemy came up with the idea of having a circle within a circle, basically. So you have Mars is moving on the standard circle, the sphere that Mars moves on, and within that you have it moving on a little subcircle. And when you have this kind of game, you can reproduce the retrograde motion of Mars. This was known as an epicycle. So when people talk about circles within circles, this is sort of what they mean. The thing is, as you make closer and closer observations, you have fairly complicated motions for the planets, and you end up having to have lots of these epicycles in the system. And so you begin to have this really complicated looking sort of universe. So Nicholas Copernicus hypothesized the existence of the heliocentric universe and you know, there's an interesting life, lots of fun stories and stuff, so I'm not going to spend much time on it. But this is not so long ago, actually, about historical standards. And he said that we live in a sun-centered universe. And this actually created a lot of problems. I mean, it was a very strange thing to say. Very often, we talk about the Copernican Revolution. And when we talk about the Copernican Revolution, usually what we mean is that it was a revolution that took us away from being the center of the universe. So when I say if you do something that's sort of along the lines of the Copernican Revolution, I'm sort of saying you're taking a step away from the human bias. And certainly in retrospect, that's really what happened, and it fairly quickly became what happened in practice, because people got very upset that man's central place in the universe has changed. But it actually wasn't like that so much at the time, because back in the day, Earth was at the center of the universe not because we were so wonderful, but because we were in the muck and we were sinful, and the really wonderful, ethereal, perfect things were out in heaven. Okay, so this idea of elevating dirty man, sinful man, out into the heavens, in a sense, was very strange, actually. And then you have this other problem: is okay, if we're over here, we're not at the center, what keeps us up there? Everything falls toward the center. Everything goes to the center. So what is going on? So there was no theory of gravity, right? There was no, who knew how to solve that problem. So this was not adopted overnight, even by the astronomers who had to agree that this was probably a better fit for the measurements. There was the other issue, which is the measurements weren't very good. I mean, these days, if you compare what you would have if you had a Ptolemaic universe and what you have with a sun-centered universe, and you compare the observations, there's no contest. But in those days, the observations weren't all that good. And in fact, they were improved dramatically. Well, okay, so sorry. Galileo played a role in having this happen. Remember, he invented the telescope. And with the telescope, he could actually see the phases in Venus. And, you know, you have two different points of view. You've got one where the sun is going around the Earth. Venus is inside the sun. There are ways in which you could tell that it was closer to us than the sun. In fact, because Venus can actually go across the sun. It seemed to transit, it can pass from the sun. So, but what you should see in terms of the phases of Venus, in this case, when Venus is close to the sun, they will always sort of look dark with sort of just edged pieces. But if Venus goes around the sun and Earth also goes around the sun, there'll be periods where you can see a full Venus. You can have a totally different evolution of the phases. And so Galileo could see this, and this is a very strong observable evidence that in fact things are going around the sun rather than the sun going around the Earth. Added to this, Hacker-Bruyer made really careful observations, and much more so than anyone had ever done. I mean, sort of hiding off, taking really careful measurements. And Johannes Kepler managed to get his hands on Bruyer's notebooks and analyzed them and everything. And what he found was that with the careful measurements, the heliocentric universe was circles and the Ptolemaic universe was circles. Neither were. They don't fit. What he found was that in order to make it fit, he actually had to assume that the planets moved in elliptical orbits, very slightly elliptical. And when he did that, he was able to fit the data basically perfectly. And he derived from his observations three laws that mathematically describe the motion, which we know as Kepler's laws. Okay? So this was really what describes what's out there to a very good precision. This is pretty revolutionary, because he threw out the perfect circles. Okay? And that's sort of sacrilegious. So that's a big deal. And who, I mean, why would God use an ellipse? Right? So then along came Newton. And Newton came up with what we call the universal law of gravitation. And he found that it describes motion on Earth just like we've been doing, okay? You can take cannons and shoot them and you can predict where things fall. You can drop balls and it works. So that is Newton, okay? And he figured out, you know, he has this law of gravitation and it works here on Earth. Then he took that law and from this mathematics, he was able to derive Kepler's three laws of planetary motion. And what he found was that the planets are governed by exactly the same law of gravitation as we have here on Earth. Think about that for a moment. Okay? Imagine what it would have been like if you're sitting there fussing around with this law of gravity that you have with the muck here on Earth, okay? And you suddenly realize that you are the first person in all of humanity to understand planetary motion. You just fit this data. That means you understand the force that governs the motion of the planet. I mean, if that doesn't make you an arrogant guy, I can't imagine what would. Newton was amazing, though. I mean, he was very deserving. And this is huge, huge conceptual stuff. At any rate, you'll find your text talks about Kepler's laws. Fun to read. We're not going to do anything with those. We are going to deal with the force of gravity, which I'll get started on now. Any thoughts, questions? It is purely attractive. So if I have two masses, big M, little m, I describe the force between them with this vector equation. There are some assumptions here. Right now, I'm going to tell you we're going to deal with spherically symmetric things. And what do you mean when you talk about this distance r between the two masses? Is it between the edges of the masses, the back edges of the masses, or the middle? And it turns out that it's due to the middle. It's so you can assume that r is measured from the middle, and we're going to come back to that. But it's a vector. This minus sign is what means it is attractive. So if I were to calculate the force of big M on little m, it would be this. This minus sign says it's in the minus r hat direction, which means it's pulling this little m back toward that big M. That's what makes it attractive. Okay? This big G, not to be confused with little g, this big G really just sets the scale of the force. And this is Newtonian gravitational constant, if you want. It's a vector force, so you have to treat it like it's a vector. You can imagine having big ropes pulling on things, and you have to worry about direction. So if I have a mass little m here at the origin, and I place a mass m1 over here on the y-axis at a distance r1 away, m2 a distance r2 away, the total net force is going to be a sum of the force of each of those two. So I'll have a g times m1 times little m over r1 squared that will be pulling little m up in the y-direction. I'll have a force g m2 times m over r2 squared, which is pulling in the x direction, and then you do a vector sum, you're going to end up with this mass being pulled basically with a net force in that direction. Right? So don't forget the vector aspect of this force. But other than that, it's sort of like a lot of what you've already been doing. You've already summed the forces. Yeah?
In that picture, would that assume that M1 and M2 are not?
Yeah, if I ask you, you know, what is the net force on this object, don't assume they're all moving. It is true that M exerts a force on M1, M2 exerts a force on M1, they both exert a force on M2, all of that is happening at one time. So if I were to say, calculate where all these bodies are in 2 weeks, and if you could do it, take me to Stockholm with you. Actually, three-body problems are very hard to solve, or impossible, actually. So you could, with a computer, calculate an arbitrary accuracy. But yeah, they will all move, because if these are exerting a force on that one, that one's exerting a force on that. But any problem you see will be phrased in such a way that you don't want to get twisted by that, because it will basically be asked in an instantaneous sense. So, since we have the force of gravity now in its sort of raw form, what I'd like to do is to look at how energy works in a gravitational system. So we're going back to potential energy now. So imagine that we have some mass M, and I have another mass, I'll call it little m, which is out at some radius R1. I better not write it that way, though. So it's out at some radius R1. And what I'd like to do is now reach in, play God. I want to reach in and pull this mass out so that it is at a distance, which I'll call R2. Okay? And what I'd like to do is to ask, how much work does it take for me to move this object out from R1 to R2? By doing that, you're actually also getting a measure of how much energy do I put into the system to move it from R1 to R2. I'm adding potential energy because, remember, I'm effectively taking the thing from a low height to a larger height, so I'm increasing the potential energy in the system. So by calculating the work here, I'm actually determining how the potential energy varies between these two objects as a function of the distance between them. So that's where we're headed. For simplicity, we're going to say that we just move out along the radial line. All right. So let's say that we move just a little bit in R. Then I know that the differential amount of work that I'll do will be equal to the force I'm exerting dotted into some differential distance ds. But in this general coordinate that we use for our most formal definition of work, ds, it's dr, and we're moving in r. So if I move out a differential amount ds, I'm moving out a differential amount dr. So this is f dot dr. Now note that the force that I'm having to exert as I go up, I'm having to exert it outward in the radial direction r, because I'm pulling it up, which is in the same direction as the dr. So f dot dr is f times dr. And now what I'd like to do is integrate all of these little bits of work as I go from r1 to r2. So the total work is equal to the integral from R1 up to R2 of F dr. And this is now magnitude F because I've already done the dot product. So this is going to be equal to the integral from R1 to R2 of G times big M times little m over R squared dr. Okay? And that integral is minus G m little m 1 over R evaluated between R1 to R2. You okay with that? Integral 1 over R squared is minus 1 over R. So that means the work that I do goes as minus G times M times little m of 1 over R2 minus 1 over R1, or minus G M little m over R1. I don't want to write that. I'm going to leave that as an R2. Now note that R1 is a smaller number than R2 because I'm moving half. So this quantity, this being smaller, means that this term is bigger than that term. So the amount of work I do is net positive. Since it's net positive, that means I'm putting energy into the system, I'm increasing the potential energy, and that better be the way it is because it's equivalent to taking a book and raising it. So I know that I put more energy into the gravitational system. Okay? So, if you look at this, then we say that the work is equal to this change in these two terms. Suppose that I define the gravitational potential energy to be equal to minus G M little m over R. Then what you have as I go from R1 to R2 is nothing but the change in that quantity, which is why I'm defining that. Okay? So just like in a spring, we have the potential energy going as 1/2 kx squared. The potential energy for a gravitational system goes as gmm over r, with a negative sign, oddly enough. It's negative. So if we were to plot the potential energy as a function of r, it would look like that. So a way to think about this is that if I have only so much energy in the system and I start moving out in R, so I have a rocket and I send it up in R, okay, it has a fixed amount of energy in it and it's going up in R, what's going to happen? It's going to go out, but how do I say this? It'll use up that energy until it reaches this height, and then it has no choice but to go back down. Because basically, this defines the amount of energy that I think I'm trying to do something I probably shouldn't do. So let me back away and not worry about it. This is U as a function of R, as this sort of equation gives you. Okay. So let me spend my time doing something else. You might say, you know, this is not what I'm used to. Right? I'm very used to thinking that the gravitational potential energy goes as mgh. Right? So if you take these, what are we doing with this? Okay? So let's look at it more carefully. It's not like these two things are actually inconsistent. They just sort of look inconsistent right at the moment. So remember, when we've used MGH, we've always used it when you are at the surface of the Earth, basically. So the situation that we have when we use MGH is when we have some big Earth here, and we have a little distance here, okay? So that being H, right? Now, what I'd like to do is to look at this problem in terms of changes in R, because we're now looking at sort of things in a slightly different way. So I'm going to call this H. I'm going to say that this is a distance, little delta R. So that means when you are at this point, you are at the radius of the Earth. And when you are at this point, you are at the radius of the Earth plus delta R. Okay? So that's really what we mean when we talk about little h. So let's look at the change in the potential energy when you go from the height of the radius of the Earth above the center of the Earth to the radius of the Earth plus delta R. And we have the change in that potential. We have the form of it right here. So let's just use that. And what we find is that the change in potential energy is equal to minus g times the mass of the Earth times the mass of whatever object we have going up at distance h. Okay? Divided by I'm going to also define this because I'm going to screw it up because I wrote it in my notes as just a little r. So this could also just be, we'll just call it little r that would go up too, because otherwise I'm going to drop something here. Okay, I better not pay too much attention to my notes because I think I've written it both ways in here. All right, so delta E goes as G-M-A-M-E-M, and this would be the final piece, so this would be over Let me, because I don't want to screw this up. It gets involved a little bit, and I don't want to mess it up. So I'm going to call this distance right here r, little r. And that's equal to r sub e plus the little delta r. So that's where things get screwed up. So I'm going from r sub e to r sub e plus delta r, which is something that I'm defining as little r, which means this is little r plus g m e m over r sub e. Okay? Sorry about that. So now I want to collect terms. So this is equal to basically I want to now combine them into the same thing. So this becomes minus G big M E times M times R sub E plus G M E times M times little r. Okay, so this is starting to look a little bit nasty. I can simplify this by saying that this is G times M E times little m times r minus r sub e over r sub e times r. I'm going to expand little r into its little delta r. So this is gme times m over r sub e times r sub e plus delta r, which remember is very small. And this is r sub e plus delta r minus r big r sub e. Okay? And now if you look at this, this r sub e and that r sub e cancel. This delta r is really tiny compared to that r sub e. So this is effectively zero. So this whole thing is g times m sub e times m times h over r sub e squared, and this is what we have defined as little g. Okay? So m times little g times h works perfectly well so long as h is very small compared to the radius here. Okay? But it's the same thing, though. Of course, you don't. I mean, if I give you a problem near the surface of the Earth, use MVH. It's much simpler. You don't want to go back to that 1 over r bit and try to work it out. Because you'll just basically end up redoing what I just did if you wanted to do it wrong. And that's fine. Okay, any questions? Does this alleviate your concerns that the potential energy expressions that I was giving you disagree? I hope so. I can tell some of you are very good. Yes? No, this is an approximation. But in the limit that delta r is really small compared to big r, then this is just goes to zero and we have all zero. I'm sorry. In the numerator, this one and that one cancel. And that delta r is what we started out with. Okay. So MGH say we should feel good about that. All right, so now suppose I have a mass here and I place another mass in space out there. That second mass is going to feel a force due to the first mass. What does that do to it? It's due to gravity. How does this mass know that mass is bigger? What is the essence of the force of gravity? I don't know. So what we do is we make up a mechanical model, some idea, okay? Because if you think about it, it's very useful to have I want to think about just this mass by itself for a moment. If this mass is in an empty universe, it has no force on it. Okay? If this mass comes along and I have some big black box here, this mass doesn't know what's inside the big black box, and there happens to be a big mass there, then when I put this mass at this point in space, it does feel a force. Okay? So one way to think about it is whatever this mass is over here, it is creating a condition in space around it such that if I place another mass at that point, it will feel a force in a certain direction with a certain energy required. So we call that condition in space the gravitational field. And the gravitational field then generally, we use the word field when we're talking about something that exists at every point in the universe. Okay? So the gravitational field is defined as the force due to gravity per unit mass at each point. So if I want to picture the gravitational field at a certain point due to this big mass M, here's M. If I go over here, the force at that point is going to be radial and toward this big M. The gravitational force per unit mass basically divides out the size of the mass that I put here. It leaves only a dependence on this thing. So the gravitational field, for example, is equal to G big M over R squared in the R hat direction. That would be the gravitational field. And it divides out the size of the mass that I'm using to sort of test what's going on in space around this other thing. This may seem a little bit weird, and we're going to do a little bit of it now, and part of why I'm doing it is because you're going to do a whole lot of it next semester in 114 when you talk a lot about the electric fields and magnetic fields. So I just want to get you a bit acquainted to the idea here. Imagine if I put a mass right here, I just have some test mass, and I just put it here in space, it's going to feel a force going toward this M. If I put it over here, it'll feel a force going in the same direction, but it will be weaker by this 1 over R squared dependence. If I put it over here, it's going to be out that way. So if I want to picture the gravitational field due to this big mass, I can picture at every point there's a vector that goes with the magnitude of the gravitational force that you would have. You put a little test mass there, and in the direction that you would have due to the force of gravity, etc. So you can sort of picture at every point in the universe around that mass little arrows that represent what the force would be on a little test mass if I put it there. And that mental distribution that you get in your head is what we think of as a gravitational field. So the way that Newton talks about gravity is that if I were to plop down a mass right here, it creates a gravitational field. It makes a change in the nature of space all around it. Creates this field, which exerts a force on everything else. And this process happens instantaneously. Okay? That is sort of the gravitational concept that you get out of Newtonian physics. Einstein came along, and what he observed is that if you're in an elevator and you have no windows and it starts to accelerate upward, you feel heavy. So he actually said, suppose there's no difference between an accelerating reference frame, meaning the elevator car, okay, and gravitation. And he hypothesized this as called the principle of equivalence. And it means some pretty weird stuff. So for example, that what it means is that you cannot tell, according to the principle of equivalence, whether you're standing on Earth in a box with no windows, or if you are in a rocket ship that is accelerating at 1G. that there's no physical way to tell the difference. That's what Einstein's equivalence principle actually means. But it actually has some very weird implications. Imagine what happens if I have a little light gun that shoots a very short pulse of light out as it goes. If I'm on Earth here, and you would imagine that if I shoot it, it must go straight, okay? If I'm here, think about what happens. If I shoot, I'm standing here, I'm holding this thing, and as I shoot it, let's blow up the picture of the car. Okay, I'm holding my laser pointer. As the light travels toward the other side, this elevator car, the rocket ship, accelerates around it so that as the light travels, since it travels at a finite speed, the path that it takes will look like that. So if you really believe in the principle of equivalence, then what you're saying is that this situation is physically identical to that physical situation, which means gravitational fields must also bend space, because light travels in a straight line in space, and light, even here, should travel in a curve, albeit small because the force of gravity is weak on Earth. But conceptually, that's what it means. So that actually is the foundation of what we know as Einstein's general theory of relativity. And because you see these straight lines going in curves, it actually turns out that it's a geometrical theory. And he interprets gravitation as a curvature of space. And if we do a little special video, we also screw around with time. So it's sort of a curvature of space-time. So it's a very real physical picture. You don't really talk about gravitational fields, okay? We have another picture of forces, which comes out of quantum theory, which is quantum field theory. And the Higgs that was just discovered at CERN is sort of the last piece of a very successful theory that describes three of the four major forces we have in the universe, the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic. In this picture, it takes advantage of something which is known as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And there is a form of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that says if you have a system, there's an uncertainty in the energy of that system if you observe it over an absurdly small amount of time. Okay? So if you put that backwards, it basically says if I observe a system over a short period of time, I really don't know what the energy of the system is. So that provides a loophole in quantum mechanics to actually break energy conservation briefly. And what that means is that there's a way, and I don't think I'll take a lot of time to do it, there's a way in which you can interpret a force as an exchange of particles that sort of happens within this loophole of breaking conservation of energy in quantum mechanics. If it sounds a bit crazy, good. I spent more time talking to you, you think it's even crazy. It is pretty wild stuff, but it is well within the realm of quantum mechanics. So there's a very particular conceptual picture of a force, which is an exchange of particles, which we call gauge bosons, because we like to make up weird names for this. And so for electromagnetism, that gauge boson is a photon. For the weak nuclear force, it's called Z, or the W. Okay? For the strong nuclear force, it's called the gluon. If you were to interpret gravity in this way, and you don't yet have a working model of quantum gravity, and most physicists believe such should exist, and this kind of theory should exist, it would be an exchange of particles called gravitons. Who's right? These are all just totally invented from human mind, right? You have three different pictures of gravity, and who's right? So this is the power of science, right? What you do is you go out and you look. It turns out that you can find things where Newton predicts one thing, Einstein predicts something else, and the measurements agree with Einstein. Okay? So, but when you go to the case where things are not moving that fast, where the masses are not that huge, Newton does really well. Okay? So we really live by Newton. You're going to live your life, and it's going to really be governed by Newton. Okay? But if you turn into some orbital scientist or something like that, then you may have to worry about relativistic corrections. It does actually matter. GPS only works because we do general relativistic corrections too. Okay? And that has changed the world. Okay? But most of you won't be doing that. So anyway, science is pretty cool, and you know, the whole idea of, is there some right answer? I mean, it's sort of bizarre to think about it, but not necessarily, and all we're doing is creating models. Okay, so I've lost my little thingy. All right, so I'm going to hand out your exams. This is the distribution. It's actually very good from one of my exams. It is probably about as good as I've seen on exam one or one of my exams on 13. What you'll note is that it is more Poissonian than Gaussian. What I mean by that is you've got a very long tail over here. So the mean is 74, but it's probably not safe to think of that as being what I think of as the mean, right? Because when you think of a mean, you're usually thinking of sort of the center of the Gaussian. If I were to draw a Gaussian, it would look something like this on this particular test, just so you know. So the median is 79. So that means half of you are above that, half of you are below that. Don't worry about that. What I'd like you to do is sort of look at this, and don't anybody ask me about letter grades. I don't even think about letter grades. Let me tell you what you need to know, okay? What you need to know is that if you're up here, you're doing really fine. You're getting everything that you need to be getting out of the course. You may have made a couple of silly errors in here. You should be continuing to do what you're doing and think about what you missed and see if it indicates that you can improve anything you're studying. But basically, you're doing great. You probably made a silly mistake in your thinking. But I don't have any problems. The warning I have for you is that usually my means are down at 65 or 70. So if you get real cocky about this and you stop studying, you're going to find yourself way down. Okay, so just keep doing what you're doing. If you're in here, okay, you're basically doing okay. I don't have any real fundamental worries, but clearly you're starting to miss some things that you probably should have gotten. So it probably indicates there's something with your study habits you ought to be thinking about a little bit, you weren't quite tuned up, or you made some mistakes that maybe you shouldn't have, and just, you know, look carefully at your exam solutions and try to think if there's a way in which you might improve being careful and making those mistakes. If you're down here, you need to worry. Okay? You do not need to worry in that there's water already under the bridge. The syllabus is set up so that this exam doesn't even have to count. Okay? You can look at this and say, okay, I made a poor grade, but it doesn't even count. The worry is that if I look at the best indicator for what your exam grade is next time, it is this grade. Right? So you need to make sure that that's not true. So what I would take away is if you're down in here, something's broken. I don't know what it is, but you need to change something or you'll find yourself there next exam too, because I'm in a rut and the exams are going to be sort of similar. And if anything, the next exam will strike you as harder. The mean will be low. The typical pattern is that the mean goes lower and the tail gets tucked up underneath it a bit, okay? So you get a more Gaussian distribution, but that is not to say things are any easier. So you have to adjust whatever you're adjusting in your approach to the course, your time management, who you're talking to, whether you're just listening in workshop without actually engaging, or whatever it is, you need to examine now how you're approaching the class, because you have to fix it now. This stuff builds. I can't fix it. I can't even help you fix it when it's 6 months, 6 weeks. Okay, that said, I've posted the solutions. You need to look at them very carefully. This is true for all the exams, including the finals. We do make mistakes, okay? And I will fix those if there's something that is unfair. That said, we don't make a ton of mistakes, and I don't want you to bother me unless you have a decent case. So I'd like you to look carefully at the solutions, make sure you understand them, and then think about how we actually grade them. Grade them with partial credit. What we're trying to do is understand what you're thinking, and the grade is meant to reflect that, your process of thinking through. If you make an algebraic error at the end, it shouldn't cost you very much. Okay? But anyway, if you have a problem, I'll then fix it. I have posted on the web regrade policy, which basically just says, go look at the solutions before you bother me. But once you look at the solutions, if you think something was none wrong, you bother. Okay. If you don't get the grade you would like and you're concerned, I also have on the web something called a troubleshooting guide, which basically reflects a conversation that I've had with many students who had exactly that feeling, who walked in my office. And somewhere about 3 years into teaching this class, I realized we were having the same conversation. So I thought I would just put it out as a troubleshooting guide. If you go, you can find that if you're bothered, you might fit one of these categories, and I'm sort of giving you there my advice to you that I get. Doesn't mean you don't come talk to me, it's just a different avenue where you can go and hear it. Okay, so one last thing that I want to tell you, which is on the last problem, problem number 6. I'm sure it was your favorite. We actually had something, from my point of view, that was absolutely horrific that happened. Here's the problem. This whole thing is accelerating upward with A. We've got a mass hanging by a string and another string that goes over a pulley, which is on an inclined plane. And this was just meant to be your fun problem for the test, okay? And so what I'm asking you is if the tensions in those two strings are equal, what's this angle theta? Okay? Now, along the way, about 75% of you solved the problem by saying that the acceleration was zero, which is explicitly not true and explicitly wrong. Because if that acceleration is not zero, I mean, is zero, why is this block actually moving up with this elevator, right? I mean, so that's clearly something wrong for where we are in the class. The reason that I bring it up was that if you solve this problem perfectly and you don't set A to zero and you solve it, you'll get a certain angle here. If you set A to zero, it turns out that A cancels out, which means you'll also get the right answer. And boy, does that suck, in my opinion. Okay? So I am telling you this. It meant that my fourth grader, who was doing problem 6, had to look very hard at what you wrote, okay? If you set arbitrarily, or not arbitrarily, because it, you know, makes the problem easier to solve in principle, if you set A equal to zero, you lost 10 points, and that's why, okay? Even though you got the right answer. So the bad side of that is you got screwed because we're looking at what you're thinking, and that thinking was very wrong for this, okay? That's the double-edged sword of partial credit. Because you also, if you look, you probably got a lot of points because we're looking at how you're thinking and we don't have to look at the problem. So sorry about that. Yes.